I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Paging Vladimir Putin through the fog of Russia, the fog of Washington, too. The martial arts master in the Kremlin, the world's model of strongman rule for 17 years now in the restless remainder of the Soviet Empire. Putin is the man not least who is repurposing the internet and digital hacking culture. The internet, which he once saw as a threat to his rule over Russia, it now looks like his weapon in the world, even our world. What does it say that many Americans want to hold Putin responsible for Donald Trump's election? What does it say that our president reveals something like a guy crush on Putin and his way with power? A lot of questions won't be answered this hour about the FBI's investigation of collusion between Putin and Trump interests in our 2016 campaign, but a lot of clarifications begin with our guest, Richard Lurie, a Boston boy, a Russia hand, translator, novelist, and historian who's been tutoring us on Russia for decades. His forthcoming book in July is Putin, His Downfall, and Russia's Coming Crash, which gets ahead of the story, Richard. We love this book. You like to remind us to put aside Russia for a moment. Let's talk about Russians. Putin's grandfather was a cook for Stalin. His father was KGB, as was Putin himself. What do we have to know about this guy?
Well, here's one quick story that I think has to tell a lot about Putin. During the siege, 900-day siege of Leningrad, at its height, Russians were dying at the rate of 10,000 a day. Putin's mother, from sheer hunger and exhaustion, fell to the ground. Hmm. People assumed she was dead, so they just flung her onto a pile of corpses. And then someone passing by heard a little moan issue from her lips and realized that she wasn't dead and got her down and got her some attention. That's your mother. That's not a story that any other world leader that I know of, from Merkel to Trump, could tell about their mother. That has to shape you to some degree. And your father and your grandfather worked with the security agencies, fought in wars, very strong image of patriotism, and also working for the Secret Service. And he was a cook for Stalin. He had to be trusted with Stalin's life.
You say his only religion is power and fear.
I would add loyalty to that, too.
I meant to say that.
Yeah, loyalty is very important because in the world that he lives in, I say there's two kinds of societies. This is very crude. But there's the rule of law and the law of the jungle. Russia is still the law of the jungle. Internal enemies get killed. Political enemies get killed. Somebody, a senator, was shot dead on the streets of Kiev 3 or 4 days ago. Journalists get killed. So loyalty is all there is. There are no other values that people really believe in. There's loyalty. Hand washes hand, as the Russians say. He believes in strength. And he believes that the world is a dangerous place and there are enemies on every side and the weak get beaten and it's a fool who's not ready.
You picture him rising naturally to the top as a sort of popular, rough and tough street fighting chief in a Darwinian state. Is that fair?
Yeah, he was a very lucky guy. He was a little bit like Chauncey Gardner in Being There by Kaczynski. I mean, he had some great luck. When he returned to the Soviet Union in 1990, after his 5-year stay in Dresden, Germany, as a KGB officer, he was thinking of driving a cab. He didn't know what he was going to do. The world was falling apart, and he didn't know what he was going to do. 9 years later, he's running the whole show. That doesn't happen by accident or by chance or good luck, but he had a lot of good luck. The thing is, he not only demands loyalty, but he shows it, and that was very important in his rise. He is a man of values.
He was given the job virtually by Boris Yeltsin, and he's thrived on his instinct. But you're also saying in this book, Richard, that he may have blown his main mission, his modernizing mission. Explain that.
When Russia was swimming in oil money in the around 2005 and to 2008, when the oil peaked at $150 a barrel, Putin had the chance to change his society, his economy, Russia itself, from a top-down authoritarian petro-state to a knowledge-based, more inclusive society that would have pulled in more people who had a stake in the future of the country. Had he made that move, Putin would have secured the loyalty of a great number of citizens, and he wouldn't have to suppress demonstrations because he'd have solid loyalty on the part of a great part of the country and not just the old-timers and the conservatives.
You know, Winston Churchill's line cannot be improved on. I mean, he said, Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. But we forget that last line. He said, perhaps there is a key. That key is Russian national interest. What does it tell you about Putin that he may have missed his move?
Well, as Putin sees it, Russia's national interest is to become great again. I mean, he can make a case for that much more, I think, than Donald Trump can for making America great again. As Hillary Clinton pointed out, America is pretty great already. But Russia really needed to make a comeback on the world stage from the humiliation of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the pathetic nature of the Russian economy throughout the 90s. So in that sense, he had the right vision, let us say, or he had the vision of, let's not call it right or wrong, the vision of making Russia great again. He wants a strong team. He wants to win. He'll play dirty to win, as we've seen from the Olympics and we've seen from the American elections. But he's got a team Russia, and he wants it. He's the captain, and they're going to win no matter what it takes. But he made some wrong calls, in my opinion, and that's going to cost him his place in history. He could have been great. He could have been a contender or even a champ. And now he's going to be someone like Brezhnev, who ruled for many years but didn't really accomplish much.
Come to the critical Trump connections. Three simple questions. Did he interfere or did he try? Two, did it have an effect? And third, critically, what was Donald Trump's part in what people are calling collusion, what the FBI is investigating as collusion?
Well, I don't think there's any big doubt now that the Russians interfered in our elections. And you know, they hacked the Democratic National Committee and released that information through WikiLeaks. They didn't do the same for the Republican Party. That, to me, is a gigantic circumstantial evidence that they were trying to tilt the election towards Trump. Now, the question is, I think it'll never be known if it was significantly or critically effective. Like, it's going to be one of those mysteries that we just never get to the bottom of. But in a certain sense, it doesn't matter, because the very act itself is so outrageous that that's what needs to be focused on. You know, whether it bought Trump 10,000 votes or not is another question.
The critically interesting thing about Trump's collusion, such as it was, is the FBI may never prove it, but Vladimir Putin knows what happened. Will he tell?
Well, that's the thing is, Putin holds the winning card in this particular game, because there was that dossier that floated around that had all sorts of salacious stories about Donald Trump in Moscow.
And didn't make sense to me, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, it had a made-up quality to it, but the thing is, even if they produced a videotape, it could be denied to the end of time by just being classy photoshopping. So it doesn't prove anything. But if there was collusion between the Putin regime and the campaign team of Donald Trump, you can bet your bottom dollar that Putin's people were documenting it at every step of the way. If there was a secret meeting between Trump's lawyer and a representative of the Russian government in Prague, as is alleged in that dossier, you can be sure that room was bugged by the Russians, and they can prove collusion. And that's the strongest card that they can play. They won't want to play it because it's somewhat of a nuclear option, but it's very good as a threat.
Richard, what's his comeuppance, if any, for more than meddling in Syria?
Well, two things we've already seen. In 2015, in December, there was a Russian passenger jet was blown out of the air over the Sinai Desert. ISIS took credit and said it was vengeance for Syria. 2016, very recently, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was assassinated in Ankara by someone saying this is vengeance for Aleppo, quite specifically. The thing is, a lot of the fighters in Syria on the other side against Assad are Russians or from various Muslim parts of Russia. I think the bill has yet to come in, and I think it's going to be a little bit more expensive than Mr. Putin expected.
What did he win for himself in the Middle East?
Well, he won the image of a man who's unafraid to act. And the Chinese admire him greatly for that very reason. He's reinserted Russia as a serious player in the Middle East. He's gotten a long lease on his naval base in northern Syria, outside of Latakia. So far, it's been mostly win-win-win for him. I think the bill comes later, and I think it's going to be stiffer than he figured.
There's another big dimension, not just Putin coming to the world, but the world coming to Putin. The Berlusconis of this world, including former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, and now Donald Trump, are trying to learn something of his ways, with a lot of buddy-buddy admiration, it feels like. Do you want to warn us about that?
Well, you know, the thing is, strength looks attractive, clarity looks attractive at a time when a lot of people, half of America, it feels very swiftly changing, confusing, and even offensive in a lot of ways. And so what Putin is able to project so far, he could have other troubles coming down the road, vengeance for his part in Syria being one of them. He projects strength, he projects confidence, he makes America look weak, foolish, and always getting caught flat-footed. And then, of course, he has a system in which people have the illusion of democracy. They have fancy graphics, they have quiz, they have talk shows, they have elections, but they don't mean anything. And, you know, Stalin's foreign minister Molotov had a great line. He said, there's only one problem with free elections. You don't know who's going to win.
Stand by, Richard. We're opening the Russia File with Richard Lurie. Coming up, the Sundance-winning filmmaker Robin Hessman on young Russia, now 30 and 40-somethings who came of age as Soviet communism came apart. They're still asking, who are we Russians and what do we believe? This is Open Source. The filmmaker Robin Hessman grew up through college in New England, then spent most of the 90s, her 20s, in post-Soviet Russia. The country was reinventing itself, first under Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika, meaning restructuring, then under Boris Yeltsin, then Vladimir Putin. My Perestroika was Robin Hessman's prize-winning movie about the Russian generation that is still adjusting. For a lot of her subjects, it was an identity crisis that isn't entirely over.
They didn't know that changes were going to happen until they started happening very rapidly. And there's two of the people in my film were off in the army when the changes started happening. And when they came back, it was like they came back to another planet. All of a sudden, people could walk around with mohawks on the street and not be arrested for it. And people could play music on the street and the kind of social openings that were happening. The perestroika generation was the generation that got to be critical of the Soviet Union for the first time after a childhood of being fed a certain kind of history and a certain very, very rosy view of their country when they were learning the truth that what they had been told in history in grade six was very different than what they were allowed to know about by the time they were in 11th grade. Two of the people in my film, when they were studying to become history teachers, there was one year that history exams, I believe it was 1988, history exams for the entire country were canceled because they didn't know how to grade them and how to assess them. Is it the old view of what the correct history is of our country, or is it this changing, evolving new view where certain negative aspects of the truth are coming out and allowed? And it was exciting. People wanted to talk about it. The Lyuba in my film had screaming fights with her mother about whether Lenin was a good person or a bad person. Stalin, everybody agreed already decades ago, was horrible. Although now, of course, that view is changing. But Lenin, the dismantling of the kind of iconic status of Lenin was a big change in the late 80s.
What was the moment of truth, Robin?
The moment was I was interviewing a bunch of teenagers in a school in Moscow in 2005, and it was the way that they were talking about the 90s as something that was over and that period was a finite, closed period. And certainly over the decades of Putin, from 2000 and then really since his Putin 3.0, as I call it, Putin since 2012, it has been a very, very different experience even from the first years of Putin in terms of society's openness, in terms of even freedom to gather and express one's opinion. And, and for me, that's been very disheartening.
How does your generation see the path of the future, Robin?
I think a lot of my generation hopes to have their children study abroad. My friends, I know that my friends are looking toward futures for their children wherever possible, to have opportunities in other countries. And many of my friends who stayed and for the last 20 years are now looking at ways for them also to move.
And for Russia?
I don't think there is a lot of wider political projection of what is the future of our country. I think there's certainly hope of where they wish it would go, but not a lot of realistic expectations that those changes will happen. And so just as in the Soviet times, people really focused on their individual personal lives to make their life the way that they want it to be or help make their family's life the way they want it to be. That is really where people are focusing their energies. My friends are focusing, definitely many, many of them are focusing on how to make lives better for their children than what they want for their country.
Robin Hessman's terrific Russian movie is titled My Perestroika. Richard Lurie, it sounds like an identity crisis to me on a large scale.
I can explain it fairly simply, and at least I think I can. In 1917, when Russia fell apart, the Bolsheviks were waiting in the wings, and they had everything that they would need to create a new society, from songs, flags, symbols, beliefs, ways of organizing economic production. They had an entire world view that they had opposed to the rule of the Tsar, and once the Tsar and his reign collapsed, they were ready to move in. Nothing of the sort happened in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. People were caught by surprise, number one. Number two, nobody had any alternative vision of where Russia could go except for some, you know, booming generalizations about free markets and human rights, but exactly how to do that and exactly how to get there. And then very strange things started happening. Parents and children grew up saluting different flags, singing different anthems. There's a total disconnect. And then the past was never totally, I would say, integrated into the present. Stalin's crimes were never fully discussed as Hitler's were in Germany. So there's a lot of unfinished business, and it creates a kind of a zombie culture where people don't quite know who they are, and certainly as Russians. They may know who they are as individuals, but the country is kind of lost in that respect. And Putin, having a great chance to transform the economy of Russia from a gas and oil authoritarian top-down to a more inclusive, knowledge-based economy, that I also believe would have solved the identity problem, because it would have allowed more people to have a stake in the society and to contribute to the society, and it would have created a dynamic that could have, in time, produced a new, clear national vision and identity.
That's fascinating, this picture of Russia, the home of icons, without any icons or iconography these days. David Filipov joins us live from Moscow. He's the Washington Post bureau chief there. At some ungodly hour, well into tomorrow morning, David, thank you for joining us. Are you looking at a zombie culture today?
No, I'm looking at a culture that, as Robin pointed out, is mostly focused the older people, right? Everybody older than a certain age, people who have grown up, you know, in their 30s and 40s, they're focused on making their lives better because it's become clear getting involved in politics doesn't work. You know, you're better off trying to make your own life. You're better off trying to do something for your children. However, that breaks down right when you get to the internet, modern culture, the people who don't know that they're from some former Soviet thing. They're the people who grew up now, and they are on the internet. They're on YouTube. They're like, you know, they're like the 22-year-olds or the 16-year-olds anywhere else in the world. And they don't want to think of themselves as the product of something wrong. They're thinking of themselves as Russians growing up in this new, you know, world where everybody's connected. And they don't know anything, and they don't care anything about this old Soviet era that me and Richard and Robin, and I guess you, we still think about. They're not mired in that. They're not swimming in that.
David, you've been covering the anti-corruption demonstrations in Russia for the past week and more, uncommonly large and all over the country. What did they tell you?
First of all, they told me that people in general wanted to be counted. There was a big push by authorities when these things were sort of showing up. Well, no one's going to come. No one's going to go out. Nobody, nobody's interested in this. This is just a provocation. No, people came out, and I was in Moscow. I talked to a lot of people of different ages, and they're like, well, I'm not here for anything particular. I just want everyone to know that I'm here. I want the authorities to know that I'm here. But there was a stunning amount for a demonstration in Russia of young people, again, people in their early teens and people in their late teens and people in their early 20s, were coming out, feeling it out, trying it out. What is this protesting? And, I mean, I was watching people get arrested. Over 1,000 people were arrested in Moscow alone, according to some reports.
This is important news. I mean, a protest culture where we would least have expected it, coinciding, oddly enough, with street responses in the United States to Donald Trump. First the Women's March, then against the Muslim ban. What connections, zeitgeist or otherwise, ought to be made?
Well, you know, I mean, what's very interesting is when you listen to the reaction to the protest culture in the United States and the protest culture here, you have the sort of conservative, the sort of like, hey, let's keep everything stable wing, and you hear the same refrain. These people, the protesters, say the stable majority, they're elitists. They're the cultural elite. You know, in the U.S., they'll say, these are the liberals. They're not in touch with the people. In Russia, they'll say, these are the Western elites. They don't really, you know, they're someplace over there. We're about conservative values. We're about maintaining the stability. You know, our leader knows what we want. It's about making Russia, it's about making America great again. So you have this idea, you know, instead of us thinking about Russia as this place that, you know, has been struggling and is someplace else in the world, we're going through the same thing. They're wondering, who are we? We're this place that needs to get back to our roots and make it great again. And then there's the sort of liberal kind of wing that says, what are we doing? We're part of the world. We should be part of the world, connecting with the rest of the world. We don't need all these old ideas. And that's what's happening in the United States, too, only in the other way around.
I want to hear from Richard Lurie here. I mean, us and them. Links, Richard. Strongman leadership, protest culture in the street.
I had this image of Donald Trump being a kind of a going to school, high school in his father's limo and looking out and seeing some tough kids having a street fight and kind of envying them because he was just a bully, you know, in school. But these were tough kids fighting in the street. And I think that's something of the nature of his admiration for Putin. I mean, that's kind of an aside. I would say one thing about, you know, I know a lot of young people in Russia these days, too. And I was having a really interesting conversation one day with a young filmmaker about Louis C.K. And I thought to myself, isn't this wonderful? In the early 21st century, we can have a conversation about Louis C.K. And then the next thing that he brought up was the murder of Nemtsov, the opposition leader Nemtsov, and how it could well turn into the Kirov murder that set off a wave of arrest and terror. Of course, he was wrong about that. But what was interesting to me was, yes, he was able to connect and even enjoy Louis C.K., which is amazing in itself, and yet there was part of his mind that knew that things don't always work out that way in Russia. So those are associations that make young Russians different, whether they don't like to make those associations, but those associations are there waiting to be made. They're inescapable to some degree.
Richard Lurie and then David Philippa, I want to broaden the bridge between here and there, the United States and Russia today. We're talking about the kinds of trauma that shake generations and nations. The collapse of communist Russia, 1989, and the end of the Russian Empire 2 years later. But I'm also thinking of 9/11 on American soil in 2001. Who wants to see some analogy between post-traumatic symptoms there and here? Some shared experience, some shared mood, disaffection from politics, declining confidence in voting, but also in leadership.
I think both countries have had are in a kind of post-traumatic space, and it explains a lot of what's happening these days in particular, but even the last 15, 16 years since 9/11. And I think America has yet to recover, and I think Russia has yet to recover. And the real question is, you know, can we be of any value to each other in the world in which we live in, or are we now doomed because of the Crimean annexation, which at least Putin will never give the Crimea back. And even Navalny, the head of the opposition, has said Crimea is for the foreseeable future part of Russia. So if the opposition and Putin are agreed on the point, it's a non-starter for me. And then how can sanctions be raised? And then how can relationships be improved? It looks like we're at an impasse, and we're both wary of each other because we're just both generally wary of terrorism, and the Russians are just plain wary, I would say, you know, wary of collapse. They don't feel like they live in a stable world. Russians talk about Russia collapsing. We talk about America declining, but the Russians will talk about Russia itself collapsing and ceasing to exist, returning to the size of the Duchy of Muscovy.
Stand by, Richard. I want to hear David on the connections here, us and them, that are plausible to an eye in Moscow.
Well, I mean, the first thing is that so long we in the United States, and I mean, Richard, you and I in the Cold War, we thought about Russia as a thing that needed to change. You know, we were the United States, the longest continuously, you know, democratic country in the world, electing democratic leaders for 250 whatever years. And the Russians were the ones that needed to become more like us. And this idea that we're looking down on Russia as a place that's changing and we're going to help them and provide the example, that all just went poof in the last 6 months, where suddenly we're sort of struggling to try to find ourselves and where should America be in the world. You know, our president said, well, you know, we got a lot of killers too. We're not any better than them. You know, this kind of idea of moral superiority has now become this moral equivalency. But that's from the point of view of, you know, philosophers. From the point of view of Russia, there's this growing sense, and it's fueled by Putin, and it's fueled by this gnawing sense that Richard spoke about, that the emperor was lost. And then the United States and NATO and everybody's trying to hem us in. And so you have this global angst, but you also have this sense in Russia that they're holding us back, that if only they'd let us go, we'd be back to the power that we were. And this growing parallel narrative that there's this force out there, the United States, that's trying to keep us down, and maybe they want to start a war, and maybe we're all going to, you know, be in a World War III. That was abated temporarily by what they saw as the promise of Donald Trump as this new source of, you know, we're going to take care of ourselves, you're going to take care of yourself, we're not going to intervene, we're not going to impose on you. And that kind of period is sort of waning away, where Russians thought, you know, well, at least the United States now under Trump is going to be, you know, they're going to let us go and let us be us. That's kind of the narrative that you hear, and it's kind of, you know, poignant in one way, and it's unnerving in another way, because
it's controversial. I want Richard's view on what sounds like a sort of moral or leveling of the moral playing field. Is this happening, Richard?
Well, I like that point. That was a point well taken, and you know, there was that moment of hope on the Russian side that maybe we would get off our triumphalist hobby horse now that we've been knocked off it, and maybe they could develop in their own way. You know, George Kennan, to go back, I do like to quote some of the old wise men from time to time, and Kennan said, you know, don't expect the Russians to develop like we developed. I mean, there's no possible way that they could. There's such a thing as history. There's such a thing as geography. But he really felt that in time, and with plenty of pain and travail in the process, Russians would get a good place. And he predicted that quite a while ago. A good place meaning, I would say, a viable and just society, as a, you know, economically vibrant and just society. And that's still a possible outcome for Russia.
You could certainly argue about how far they've gained, but you'd also have to wonder, measuring our own embarrassment post 9/11, post Iraq War, post George W. Bush, and now Donald Trump. I mean, the inroads in world reputation on our competence, our democratic wisdom, even our working democracy. Do you want to take a stab, David?
Well, the idea of the United States as the world leader, the country that sets the agenda, right now you can see that that's not happening. Russia right now is the broker in the Middle East. You know, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Israel. Russia is the one that you go to now when you want to get something done. The United States isn't home. This idea of, you know, the one superpower that's going to tell everybody how to go and set the agenda and lead. That's not happening right now.
Stand by, David Philip Upp in Moscow. Coming up, the outspokenly alarmist Yale historian of Eastern Europe and Russia, Timothy Snyder. He's not much worried that Russian hacking turned our presidential election. He's furious, though, that Donald Trump is trying to teach us deference, even respect for President Putin's brand of politics. This is Open Source. Timothy Snyder is the historian of Eastern Europe in the 1930s, between Stalin and Hitler. He sounded the alarm with us in mid-February that Donald Trump's unstated project is regime change for the U.S., into a country where judges bow down and journalism is on the enemy's list. This month, Tim Snyder published a 100-page handbook called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, warnings that Germans did not hear at the rise of the Nazis. And then the strangest thing happened today, reported today on the Guardian site from London. Russian hackers, according to the Guardian, broke into the Tim Snyder page on Amazon and transformed On Tyranny into a pro-Trump coloring book. Here, before anybody hacks it, is part of our conversation this month with Tim Snyder on the American peril in Trump time.
What we need to be worrying about with respect to Russia is not like Russia good, bad. What we need to be worried about is Russia as a certain kind of political solution that can be contagious, right? You can have a system where you have elections, but that those elections don't matter. You can have a system where the Constitution guarantees checks and balances, but the reality is different. You can have a system where the state is basically directed towards a support of kleptocracy on behalf of one family or a tight elite. That is an example that I would say is not attractive to people of the cast of mind, such as Hillary Clinton, but is attractive to people of the cast of mind as Donald Trump. And since Donald Trump is now the president, that's the actual thing that one should be worried about. There's another more profound question, which is Russia a positive model for Trump and therefore a possible future for us? It's not just this sort of boring, like yes or no question, did Russia throw the election or not? Did Putin and Trump meet personally or not? That's not really the issue. The issue is we have a president who regards the Russian system as a positive model. Therefore, we have to understand that model, how it works, how it can be contagious.
That's something I haven't heard, though, from him, that Russia and Putin are models of leadership. I've heard him say, and, you know, plausibly, that this is a man, we didn't choose him, but he could be a useful friend in this world. Do you stretch that evidence a bit?
No, that's a good example, because what he means in particular is Russia would be a useful ally in the war on terror. And in order to evaluate that claim, one can't just think, oh, Putin, nice guy, not nice guy, or as Bill O'Reilly puts it, killer, not killer. You have to think, how does the Russian system work? And the way the Russian system has worked since Putin's elevation to power in 1999, and this is an issue on which Masha Gessen and I actually profoundly agree, the way the system has worked is that real, fake, and unclear episodes of terrorism have been used at every step to do away with democratic and liberal institutions and to replace them with an ever harsher and more effective authoritarian regime, right? So when Russia talks about terrorism, what Russia is talking about is a means of changing a domestic regime, okay? If you know that, then you hear what Trump says about cooperating with Russia over terror in a different way. You hear it as a way of changing the regime in the United States as well. If you go after terrorism with the Russians, what that means is you're going after terrorism in order to change your own system. That's how and why they do it. And they also invent stuff that just didn't happen in order to change things around. If we're going to be serious on the left, we have to recognize that Russia represents the things we don't like. It has greater wealth inequality than we do, right? It has greater surveillance than we do. Not only do they surveil people, but they actually publish the things that people say, which is one step worse. Russia is a possible negative future for the United States. That's the cognitive value of Russia.
That's Yale historian Timothy Snyder of that provocative little book called On Tyranny. Richard Lurie, with the Putin book coming out, is with us in Mexico City. David Filipov of the Washington Post is with us from Moscow. Yasha Monk, in our studio, teaches government at Harvard. You've got a fascinating piece on Slate this week, Yasha, about hacking democracy and the web as the new Russian strategy as a world player. Explain what he is doing.
Well, I think that Putin has really recognized that in order to be the kind of world player that he wants to be, he needs to undermine liberal democracy everywhere else. And so he's using hacking as an illegal tool. He's obviously influenced in some way, at least, the American election by having allies of him hack the DNC emails. He's also using a lot of legal means. So, for example, he is systematically giving money to far-right political parties in Europe, to far-left political parties in Europe. Anybody who's willing to ally themselves with Putin gets money from him, something that's still crazily legal in a lot of Europe. And then he goes about trying to undermine democracy in neighboring countries through brute military force, like in Ukraine.
Take France as an example, with a major election coming up. What's he up to?
Well, he's done a number of things. He has financed the Front National of Marine Le Pen, but he has also had people spread fake news about her main rival, Emmanuel Macron, claiming, for example, that he has some kind of gay affair with the head of French public radio, for which there's absolutely no evidence. But there's all of these things that they're trying to do to undermine the elections. The same in Germany. They have hacked the servers of the Bundestag a couple of years ago. And in advance of elections in the fall coming up, they may very well start to release embarrassing emails about various mainstream German lawmakers.
This is an amazing turnaround about the internet itself. Can you imagine him admitting that it's not about missiles anymore, it's about information?
Well, I think it's about everything you've got. I mean, what's crazy is that Vladimir Putin does not have a strong hand. He has a country with a dwindling population, with a limited economy, with military expenditures that are still a lot lower than not just the United States, but the European Union. But he is willing to risk his men, to provoke war, to break the law, to do all of the things that liberal democracies do not do. And that means that though he has a mediocre hand, he can play it much more forcefully, and that makes him a dangerous opponent.
Are hacks less menacing than missiles? Are they effective? Are they stoppable?
What he can do is to really undermine the public's trust in democracy. One of the crazy things about all of those hacks is that they didn't find anything terribly bad. When you look at the DNC emails, there was a couple of embarrassing things here and there, but actually the substance of them was not that embarrassing. We're now in a situation to know more about our political system and actually to be more confident in the relative honesty of our political system than at any previous point in history. But the way that publics see this is emails hacked, something released, there's a scandal somewhere. I don't entirely understand what's going on, but it must be terrible. It must mean that all of those people are no good, corrupt. Let's drain the swamp.
Richard Lurie, the question that Tim Snyder provokes is not are we Russia, but are we heading that way? Are we being sweet-talked into Russianism?
I like that model. I think it's useful. We have to be careful that we don't apply it, I think, to making too much of a coinciding of the two images, because they're very different societies. And one thing I would add to his discussion about you, which I think was quite intelligent, using the fight against terrorism as a means for, in fact, destroying any vestiges of democracy in your own system. I'll point out one other thing that I don't hear said much is, you know, yes, the Russian population is dwindling. On the other hand, the Muslim population of Russia is growing very fast. And Russia is about 10% Muslim now, which means about 15 million people. They picked up a couple of million more Muslims when they annexed Crimea. And the birth rates between the two countries, as there are similar issues in the United States, are very different. And so the estimates are by 2050, Russia will be between 30 and 50% a Muslim country. And by 2030 or 35, the Russian army will be well more than half Muslim, given the nature of the youthful surge in the Muslim demographics. So two neat ideas always make me a little nervous.
Come back to Yasha Monk in our studio. Your picture of hacking as a major strategic offensive gives weight to the whole fake news phenomenon, the post-truth world. Tim Snyder, in his book, has a line, you know, among the 20 lessons, post-truth is pre-fascism. Hmm. Where is he going with that? Where are we going with it?
Well, I think this really speaks to what we can do about this Russian interference. I mean, there's some straightforward things we should do. We should strengthen our cyber defenses. When you're talking about Europe, we should stop Putin from being able to just openly finance enemies of democracy within our midst. But there's something more important. The really striking thing, talking about the United States, is not that Putin may have pushed Trump across the finish line. It's that he was within striking distance of winning in the first place. It's not that Putin and his hacker allies and his fake news allies could make people believe crazy claims about Hillary Clinton. It's that people are so willing to believe the worst about politicians and our political system in the first place. So I think we now need to recognize that there's really eroding trust in liberal democracy, that our political system is no longer able to hold the allegiance of a lot of our citizens, and that if we care about liberal democracy, if we don't believe in the moral equivalence between a system like Russia that has enemies of the Tsar murdered, that arrests protesters en masse, and our system, if we think that there's something better about our system, then we actually have to have intellectual courage to defend it. And I think Timothy Snyder is doing that. I'm trying to do that. A lot of academics and intellectuals are not doing that. They are content with just pointing out all of the things that are bad in our system. And there's plenty of things that are bad, and there's plenty of things that we need to reform. But it's enough of them just to do that instead of saying, here is why our system is actually worthwhile, and here's how we can reform it to make it a little bit better so that we can regain the trust of the population, actually fight for liberal democracy when it's endangered at home as well as abroad.
David Filipov, I want to know what the Washington Post correspondent is trying to do to enlighten us all about the lure of Russianization.
I'm one of the bad guys because I'm not trying to save American democracy here. I'm trying to humanize what's going on in Russia. It is not Putin and Putinism. That's going to end, and what's going to happen is these people we've been talking about, these young people, are going to inherit it. What are they going to inherit, and how are they going to do it? The future right now is what these 20 and 25 and 15-year-olds are going to be thinking in 10, 15, 20 years. What kind of world are they going to inherit? That's the world that we need to know more about, and that's the world I want to write about, and that's the world that hopefully we'll be able to embrace as something that all of us can live in, that isn't divided by nuclear weapons and these old Cold War ideas about who is who and who was who and who could never be who. Putin is going to, you know, pass on at some point, and we're going to have the rest of the Russian world to contend with. And hopefully we're ready to meet that, not as something that's going to be the Cold War over and over again, but a world we can all live in.
Speaking of a livable world, I want to put one more question on the table that has already too many. What if, when all is said and done, it's about the oil, stupid. The Arctic, as Putin but also Rex Tillerson could both see it, the Arctic is trillions of dollars in underwater oil. Tech plus territory. What if the understory here between Russia and the United States is it's oil, Richard?
Yeah. You know, that ain't my biggest worry. Although I remember an interesting conversation with the mayor of Moscow, who said to me, sort of semi off the record, the truth is Russia and America should be allies in the coming resource wars with China, which I thought was a strong and shocking statement to hear. But I will say that in all this conversation, I have the feeling that somehow China never gets mentioned. And in my world, climate change and China are the two main things. You know, Russia is a pain and Russia is important, you know, and the Middle East is a pain and it's important too, but it's not the big story. And after Putin goes and after the oil is used up, I mean, there'll be some oil there, but, you know, in 20 years, oil may not matter that much. Some guys may get rich in the meantime. Some guys always get rich in the meantime.
Richard, you haven't really come to your subtitles yet. Putin, his downfall and Russia's coming crash. What is that about and when?
Well, his downfall, I mean, I'll give you the short answer there. His downfall is that he had the chance to change Russia from a top-down authoritarian gas and oil economy to a knowledge-based economy, which would have made it more economically competitive and also allowed more people into the discussion about where the country is going and created a real stakeholding citizenry, which could have solved the problem of Russia's identity crisis. You know, it doesn't really quite know what it is, although the young generation does what the young generation does all over the planet, goes online. As far as Russia's coming crash, I think one comes from the other. Since he's created a society that's basically still gas and oil related, I mean, dependent, that at some point when this all comes crashing down around mid-century, when Russia's going to have to collapse once again before it finds itself, unfortunately. It collapsed in, you know, in 91, it collapsed in 1917, and it's collapsed before then, too. We won't go into that. But it'll collapse because of what Putin failed to do. The two are inextricably linked.
David Filipov, you're in there in Moscow. I mean, can you imagine this protest culture taking root, getting traction, making change? Will it be allowed to do any such thing?
It surprised us all on Sunday that there were that many people. There's obviously, you know, a desire to be counted. There's a desire for some sort of change. We're a long way away from significant change. However, we're going to have a presidential election. We're going to see how the candidates shape up. We're going to see if Putin wants to run again. We're going to see if there's anyone who's allowed to be the opposition. I mean, you know, a year ago in the United States, did anyone really think that, you know, we were going to get a complete rebellion, a complete revolution that was going to change the way that we look at the United States? I mean, this whole conversation is partly predicated on the idea that we're in a new world because of the election of Donald Trump. Right now, it seems impossible to believe that somebody like Vladimir Putin, so entrenched, is going to step aside. But what if he did? And what if that opened up, you know, the possibility for somebody else to come in? A guy named Alexei Navalny made a statement, let's have a protest on Sunday. And, you know, thousands of people came out in places where they never have demonstrations. Who knows what that could be a year from now?
David Filipov, don't take your eye off that story. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Richard Lurie in Mexico City. Thank you, Yasha Monk in Boston. Yasha also hosts his own podcast, which is called The Good Fight. See you on the podcast air, Yasha. Thanks also to Robin Hessman and Tim Snyder. Our show this week was produced by Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.